everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. We have a new feature at PRN. It's a voicemail feature. So if you're listening to this right now, it's live, but then it'll be archived at least by tomorrow morning. But you can call the voicemail. It's 862-800-6805. You give your name and or first name is enough, what show and a question. Or if you're listening live to this, you can call 888 with a one in front of it, 874-4888. And after a couple of years, too long actually, Dr. Charlie Glickman is joining me. And Charlie is a sex and relationship coach, a sexuality educator, a sexological body worker, and an internationally acclaimed speaker. He's really a good speaker. If you go to charlieglickman.com, I'll put this in my write-up, you will see him doing a wonderful presentation, Act Like a Man in a Box. Very provocative. Welcome to the program, Charlie Glickman.
Well, thank you for having me back, Diane. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you on, and you're, one of your specialties is male sexuality or masculinity and gender. And so we talked off the air. Did you get my most recent email, by the way?
I did. Thank you.
Good. So we talked off the air about wanting to discuss some things that are very, very common for men, and that is male performance anxiety, and also the difficulties many men have in receiving pleasure. And then, as I mentioned just a minute ago, you might want to watch his video. Because it's really great, and maybe, Charlie, if there's time, we'll talk about it, your presentation about acting like a man in a box. It's
great.
Right on, yeah. So, Charlie, Dr. Charlie, performance anxiety. This is a big problem for lots and lots of men. Can you just talk a little bit about some of the antecedents of performance anxiety?
Sure. Well, so I want to actually take it back to a little bit about male gender roles for the folks who don't have the time to watch my video on the Act Like a Man box, because I think it really is the foundation of what we're talking about.
Yes.
First off, credit where credit is due. I learned about this model for masculinity and how to talk about it through Paul Kibble's work and his book Men's Work, which is available on Amazon. Can't say enough good things about him. Kibble, K-I-V-E-L.
K-I-V-E-L, Paul. Okay.
Yeah. And he developed an exercise that I've actually been using as the foundation of one of my workshops called the Act Like a Man Box. And the way that it works is it's a group brainstorm with people where I ask them to describe, you know, what a real man looks like, what he does for a living, what kind of relationships he has, what he does for fun. And the thing that I've been finding fascinating about this is that I've been using this exercise for at least 25 years. I've done this workshop with groups of men, women, cisgender folks, transgender folks, all different ages, races, sexual orientation, backgrounds. And although there's some variation because different people and different cultures have different definitions for what men are supposed to be like, there's an incredible amount of consistency. As an example, the first question I ask is, you know, when you think about what the stereotypical real man is, what does he look like?
Yes, and I was fascinated by that. Fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. There are three words that come up over and over and over: tall, strong, and muscular.
Yeah,
and literally, almost every time I have done this workshop, at least two of the first three descriptors that the group comes up with are, you know, at least two of those three words, if not all three of them.
Right.
And that really shows the consistency that this Act Like a Man box has. The reason why it's called the Act Like a Man box is because men create for themselves, and the world creates for us, an incredible amount of pressure to look like we're in the box. If you've ever seen a little kid, he's running down the street and he trips and falls and skins his knees and starts crying, there's a good chance that somebody, an older sibling, a parent, a babysitter, a neighbor, whoever, will pick him up and say, you know, why are you crying? I thought you were a big boy.
Right.
And so, right.
Pretty
so the
common.
Reason why it's incredibly common. And so the reason why it's the Act Like a Man box is because what we learn is, no matter how I feel on the inside, I have to act like the guy in this box in order to keep myself safe.
Right.
So there's a lot more to be said about that, but I want to shift a little bit and look at the way that sexuality fits into the box. Because when I ask my workshop participants to talk about, you know, what this guy's sex life is, you know, we talk about his career and his friendships and his relationships, but when we talk about what his sex life is like, the answers that come back are things like, he's always ready to have sex, he has lots of partners, he's heterosexual, he has a large penis that gets hard whenever he wants, stays hard for as long as he wants to, you know, he doesn't orgasm or ejaculate until he's ready to.
Right.
And all of his sex life is centered around his penis. So it's oral sex, it's intercourse, but it's all about him doing, right? I don't know where I first heard this, but somebody once pointed out that in stereotypical heterosexual gender roles, you know, men do and women receive, right? We talk about men give their partners orgasms. Women give blowjobs, but men give orgasms. You know, so you get the guy is the gatekeeper of his partner's orgasm in that, but it also means that the focus is all on him doing.
Right.
In fact, if you read, and you probably know this, Diana, but if you read a lot of sex research about male sexuality, the vast majority of it defines sexual satisfaction as erection plus ejaculation.
That's true.
It's gotten a little better lately.
But
A little bit. But so what all of this boils down to is that for a lot of men, performance anxiety is all about having sex in that particular way. And it doesn't leave a lot of room for pleasure or intimacy or connection or, you know, any of the surface of your skin that's not on your penis, or, you know, lots of other ways that people can enjoy sex.
And you're talking about sensuality.
I am. I'm talking about
slowing down, and you know, of course, we have I think mainly porn to thank for so many men being so penis centric that it's all about the penis.
I think you're right to a degree. I think that porn definitely reinforces that. But these ideas existed before everybody was walking around with a phone in their pocket that they could watch porn on. These ideas were common when you had to go to a movie theater to watch porn. These were common before movie theaters even existed.
Uh-huh.
So I agree that porn reinforces it, but, you know, porn does that because those were the attitudes that were already present in the world.
Good point, Dr. Charlie. Good point.
Yeah. I talk to a lot of people about their porn use. So
yes,
but yeah,
I do too. And we, that's, you know, we might just digress a little bit or not. We can always come back to it because it's a very important question when working with, for me, when working with couples, and the woman often has complaints, and working with individual men too, who, anyway, so we can circle back to that if we have time.
Yeah, let's do that, because there's a lot to say about porn.
That's right. Not for sure. And we might even, I should let the listeners know that you will return next week, and you have written a book on prostate pleasure. Is that the title of it? I need to look at your website again.
The full title is The Ultimate Guide to Prostate Pleasure, Erotic Exploration from Men and Their Partners.
So we're going to talk more, I think, about prostate pleasure next week. So
fantastic.
Stay tuned, everybody.
Excellent.
Yeah.
But so circling back to this and sort of where this all connects is that because of these cultural attitudes about sex, and of course we have very little comprehensive sex education out there, you know, this really creates a lot of pressure for men. You know, we create it for ourselves, our partners create it for us, and I have lost track of how many men I've talked with who contact me because they are freaked out because they're having erection difficulties.
Yes.
And one of the things that I always tell them is that anxiety causes erection difficulties. I don't call it a dysfunction, because if there's not a medical situation going on, it's not actually a dysfunction.
That's a good point. That's a good point. That said, that when I get a new client who's complaining of erectile dysfunction, I always ask, have you been checked out by a urologist? Because we need to know if there are the physiological components of it, and I'm sure you do the same thing. But especially for younger men, it's often psychological, emotional, all tied in with the performance anxieties.
Well, and you are right that if there is, you know, erection or difficulties with erection can be a sign of serious medical conditions, especially cardiovascular concerns.
Right.
So that is worth getting checked out. But, you know, if somebody wakes up in the morning and he's got a morning erection, but he has difficulty getting an erection when he's having sex with his partner, we know that there's not likely to be a medical issue because it's situational.
Right. It's situational, and the morning erection is a pretty good sign that his physiological parts are working, the blood flow, the nitric oxide inside the penis, and all that. Working.
Exactly.
That morning wood.
Exactly. And the thing that often confuses people about this is that they don't understand why he can't just push through whatever is stressing him out. And the way that I always explain it is that, you know, if you are an animal walking through the woods, you know, a deer or, you know, whatever the animal is, right? And then suddenly you're being chased by a bear. That is not the time to have an erection. That is the time to run. When our fight-flight mechanism kicks in, the blood goes to the muscles. Right? But unfortunately, our bodies don't know the difference between the adrenaline that happens because we're being chased by a bear, or the adrenaline that happens because we had a really terrible day at work and we were stuck in rush hour traffic, or the adrenaline that happens because we're feeling anxious about whether we're going to get an erection.
And that's all
and
true.
It's all the same response. I once talked to a guy who he contacted me because he was having erection difficulties and he wanted to find out what he could do. And then it turned out that he had lost his job. His home was in foreclosure. He and his wife were talking about getting a divorce. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and what I said to him was that he didn't have erectile dysfunction. He had an absolutely appropriate physiological response to a dysfunctional situation.
That's a very, I think that's a wonderful way to frame it. It's healthy, and it should be helpful.
Yeah, and it really did. And it helped him see that what was going on for him didn't mean anything about him as a man. It was just that he was so stressed out that his body was not responding in the way that he wanted to. In the same way that when you're stressed out, maybe you don't sleep very well, or you have trouble eating, or whatever it is. But that's just physiology.
Exactly.
So you can see where the Act Like a Man box fits into that, right? Because, you know, if our definitions of masculine sexuality comes into conflict with physiology, you know, Mother Nature is going to win.
Yeah. You, in that talk, I did not watch the whole thing. I plan to return and watch it. It's wonderful, and people can see it if they go to charlieglickman.com. But you made the point that it's impossible to comply with that man in the box. And one of the things that a lot of men do is to distract themselves. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure.
I would think that a lot of the men listening could relate to that.
Absolutely. Well, so there's a couple of ways that this can play out. When I talk about how nobody can comply with the box all the time, sometimes that's because some of the things in the box are not possible for everyone. For example, I'm 5'6", right? I'm never going to be tall. Right. Lots of other people, you could say the same thing. You know, some of us are, for example, disabled, right? And being disabled puts you outside the box. But also age, right? For example, when I ask people in my workshops to give me the age range of the guy in the box, we generally get something like between his 20s and 40s, maybe between 20 and 50. But that means that if you live long enough, you're going to age out of the box. So there's ways in which, you know, all men eventually, unless you die before you're 50, will no longer fit into the box. But there's also the fact that the things in the box are in a certain amount of conflict. For some people, being in the box means being a mechanic or, you know, somebody who works with your hands, construction worker, whatever. And for other people, being in the box means making a whole lot of money. Maybe you're a CEO or a high-powered lawyer. I've talked with CEOs who don't think they're in the box because they don't work with their hands. And I've talked with, you know, mechanics and plumbers who think they're not in the box because they're not rich. So there's all of these different ways in which, you know, the box is impossible to comply with. And so what we end up doing frequently as men is we pick something inside the box and turn the volume up on it to distract everyone and ourselves.
And the self.
Yeah. Yeah, I always think of it as like in The Wizard of Oz when, you know, there's the mighty powerful Oz and the floating head and the flames and the voice.
Right.
And then it turns out to be some old dude behind the curtain.
Behind the curtain.
Right.
Fabricating
everything.
It's a distraction.
Yeah.
It's a distraction.
And so, Right, and so some of the ways that men might do this is talking about sports all the time, or having lots and lots of sex with lots of different partners, or you know, let me think of some others: being a workaholic, or making a lot of money, or drinking a lot. Whatever it is that somebody believes will serve as a distraction. Basically, if I can convince you by performing masculinity, then I can protect myself from you knowing that I'm not everything in the box.
I just wanted to comment on the workaholic thing. I've seen lots of men with sexual difficulties, even before they've come to see me. They have become workaholics, and it's simpler for the man. He knows if he does A and B, he'll get C in work. But if he tries the same thing in a relationship, he's not always sure. A plus B might get C or might not. So he buries himself in work because that's predictable.
Exactly. Exactly. It's predictable. It's straightforward. And what happens when we put on this mask to try to convince everybody that we're inside the box, is that we lose track of our authentic selves. I do want to be clear that there's nothing inherently wrong with liking sports or being committed to your job or having lots of sexual partners if that's what you want to do. The difficulty here is when you're doing it because you want to present yourself like you're a real man versus doing it because it's what you genuinely enjoy. And I think that's an important distinction. Are you doing it for yourself,
an important,
or are you performing? Yeah.
Yeah, say that last thing again.
Oh, sure. So it's, are you doing this because it's what you really want to do, or
yes,
are you performing for the audience?
Right. So that's the thing that takes you potentially away from your authentic self.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that often leads to depression, which can affect the libido.
It leads to depression, leads to anxiety, it leads to all kinds of things. And so where all of this connects back to sex is, I will often ask my clients of all genders, I will ask them, how do you know when you're turned on? What does that feel like in your body? How can you, how do you know what kind of sex you want to have? And those are fundamentally the same question as how do you know when you're hungry? How do you know what kind of food you want to eat? But it's amazing to me how many people don't really know how to answer those questions, right? Because they, especially men, our belief is that, we should always want to have sex. But that would be
deeply
be hungry.
That's a deeply ingrained one right there, that men should always want sex.
Yeah.
That's one of those myths that's been around a long time.
Yes, it has. And just for the record, and I know you know this, Diana, but lots of women have internalized that too. So I've talked with plenty of women who get really upset if their partner says that he's not in the mood for sex. And maybe they'll blame themselves, maybe they'll blame him. But, this isn't just coming from men. This is something that's just in the culture.
And it's happening a little more in the last few years, I think, that women, and I've seen it in my practice, that women do complain because they want to feel wanted, they want to feel desired, and they're in a pretty good marriage. This is my experience anyway in the practice. But their sex life is fairly dormant. And So there can be lots of reasons for a man having a lower sex drive. And so that's, of course, what we explore. what are some of the things you hear, Dr. Charlie?
Well, I hear a lot of the same things. I mean, you know, some of it is that different people will have different levels of desire, mm-hmm. Desire discrepancy. And you know, that may be situational. It may just be, different people's bodies, working a little differently. But it's definitely a common concern, because if you have this idea that men always want sex, and now my husband doesn't want to have sex with me, then I must be the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what I end up doing there is really helping people unpack all of those things and, coming to a different understanding about how sex is supposed to work.
When a woman says, I must be the problem, for a lot of women, that kind of comes naturally. They are willing to take on the blame. And lots of women are raised to be pleasers and to cooperate and to all of those things and to not necessarily speak up. It's part of the way we're raised. Not me, fortunately, but anyway.
I wouldn't have guessed. Somehow I would never have guessed that. In her book, Come As You Are, Emily Nagoski talks about how when it comes to sex, we all have gas pedals and brake pedals.
Yeah.
Right? And some people have very sensitive gas pedals, which means they get turned on really quickly. Some people have really sensitive brake pedals, which means that even when they're turned on, they can then lose their arousal pretty quickly. And so to use this language, right, what happens in the stereotypical relationship, and I don't mean necessarily that this is the most common, but this is the cultural definition, is that men are supposed to have fast accelerators, and we're not supposed to be surprised if a woman's brake pedal is sensitive.
I've talked
to people of all genders and all different sexual orientations who are all over the map. Some people have sensitive gas pedals and sensitive brakes.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have sensitive brakes, but they don't accelerate very quickly. Everyone's got a slightly different setup. And so when I'm working with people around all of this, for me, the place to start is let's identify, what's your gas pedal like? What's your brake pedal like? What are the things that get you more turned on? What are the things that slow you down? And one of the pieces that consistently comes up for men is that it's a big brake pedal push if they start feeling criticized or attacked. Or scared. Right.
And then it's hard for many men to express those emotions, those particular emotions, because they want to be seen as being in control and strong. Many,
Yeah, yeah.
So it's hard for some men to be vulnerable like that and to say what's going on for them.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that is a big factor for it. I think another piece that feeds into that is that not only are boys and men not taught language for talking about our feelings, but we're also shamed if we express any emotion other than anger, basically. And so what you end up getting is, you get adult men who don't have the language to talk about their feelings because nobody taught them the words.
Mm.
There's a wonderful tool that a colleague of mine developed. If you go to the website tandempathy.org.
Can you repeat that, Dr. Charlie?
Sure. Sure. It's T and Empathy. Yeah, tandempathy.org.
Are we talking T as in the drink?
Yes.
Not testosterone.
No. T-E-A.
Yeah.
A-N-D.
Yeah.
Empathy.org. Kate Kenfield put this together. It's a deck of cards, about 150 cards, that name different emotions. What I've done with my clients is we'll take 10, 15 minutes, and they'll just flip through the cards one at a time. And any of the cards that resonate with what they're feeling in that moment, they'll set aside. And then we have like a little stack of cards that says, okay, this is what I'm feeling right now.
Good exercise.
Yeah.
Especially for men that are a bit closed down.
Exactly. Because the thing is, we have this idea that men don't have feelings, but really it's that most of us haven't been taught the language to talk about our feelings.
That's right.
So when I'm working with a male-female couple, it's a pretty common occurrence, and I'm confident you've had this experience too, where she's saying, why can't he just tell me how he feels? And he's sitting on the other end of the couch, really shut down and scared to say anything in the face of her anger.
Expand that example just a little, because that's a pretty common dynamic. The man shutting down because he can't manage the woman's anger.
Well, I think that in a lot of cases, it can be anger. It could also just be big emotions. I think that a lot of men go into withdrawal, which is, a kind of flight on the fight-flight spectrum, right? If I could put it in one sentence, it would be, I don't know how to handle this situation, or your feelings are too big for me, so I'm just going to check out. I'm going to protect myself by withdrawing from this scary situation. And I want to be clear when I say that I also know how frustrating it is to be on the other side of that. And so I have a lot of empathy for partners who feel really challenged when a guy shuts down. So this is one of those places where I think both people are having perfectly understandable reactions. It's just that what each person needs is what is triggering the other one.
And I'm also thinking that John Gottman, in his 40 years plus now of research on couples, identified that men are way more likely to stonewall than women. And it's because men often are so overwhelmed with feelings that they can't handle, and they literally get hotter under the collar, literally, when they're having conflict. So they withdraw. They want to cool down. They want to process. They want to withdraw and kind of sort it out because they're not so sure what's going on. So that's one reason that I think stonewalling is very much connected to this.
Exactly. Well, and in some ways, one of my teachers pointed out that anytime anything is too big, much, or too fast for us to feel safe, we go into fight, flight, freeze. And
it's not feeling safe,
Exactly. And looking at it from that angle, that's really frequently what the stonewalling is. you know, I don't feel safe. So I'm going to withdraw to try to protect myself. It's in a way, you know, it's no different than somebody who maybe withdraws during sex because they're feeling scared. It's a very similar mechanism.
Yeah, that's a good point, Charlie.
So, yeah. Thank you.
Yes. And, you know, let's just talk about the brain a little bit here, because the amygdala, in my experience, working with clients, people that come out of chaotic families of origin and have experienced all kinds of abuse, often, I don't know this for sure, but it seems as though their amygdalas are overwired. So they're much more likely to experience anxiety at a heightened level. And they may do this fight, flight, or freeze more readily because they don't feel safe. And, of course, we know that especially for a woman to reach orgasm, she has to feel safe. Her amygdala has to take a little nap and not be so vigilant to be able to let go. Yeah,
exactly. Well, and I actually think that that's true for people of all genders. I think the difference is that, you know, for folks with penises, it's possible to ejaculate when you don't feel totally safe. But as we know, there's a difference between ejaculation and orgasm.
Exactly.
And I don't think, right, so I don't think that men can orgasm when we don't feel safe, but we can certainly ejaculate when we don't feel safe. And so that creates a lot of confusion for people.
Yeah.
Two things.
I know we both, you and I both know about Tantra. You've done workshops. In fact, one of the last times you were on, you and another a lady were doing a workshop in Oakland on Tantra and BDSM. So I know you know about Tantra, and I know about it, and I know that it's possible for a man to have dry orgasms to kind of ride the energetic waves of his partner's orgasms, but he doesn't ejaculate. So, but a lot of people don't know that they're separate events. Not a lot of people, but many don't know that that the ejaculation and orgasm are separate events.
Yeah, one of my teachers described it as ejaculation takes place in the pelvis, especially the genitals, and orgasm happens in the entire nervous system.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, wasn't that a nice way of saying that? I've had some very good
things. Really?
I could remember.
So the orgasm happens with the entire nervous system, and the ejaculation, repeat that again because I'm making notes so I can put it in summary.
Ejaculation happens in the pelvis, especially the genitals.
Right.
Yeah,
yep, so that's right.
That's a really common situation.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but men who learn to do this tantra, to have the dry, so-called dry orgasms, can really have a much better time. They can experience a lot of pleasure. They can have more fun. I mean, a lot of people, of course, especially people with performance anxiety, Bernie Zellbergeld used to say, you know who he was, and I do too, but he wrote his first book on male sexuality was published in 1979. I remember when it came out, and I thought, this is great. Then he did an update, I think in 1991, the new male sexuality, wasn't it something like that? But anyway, he used to talk, I remember, he's passed on, but I remember going to some of his presentations, and one of the things that he would say is a lot of guys think, especially guys with performance anxiety, they think, well, we've got a job to do here. It's hard for them to relax and play and have fun. because they're all tied up with how long can they last and can they keep the erection and this and that. And these are not easy solutions, right? So there are not easy solutions for this, but...
Yeah. Well, and you know, if you think about it, you know, what you were just describing about being able to be playful during sex,
mm-hmm.
that's not in the act like a man box. Right?
Yeah, it isn't. It was left out. What do you think are the reasons?
Well, I think it's because, you know, we have this idea that, you know, I mean, I even hate the phrase male sexual performance because that either sounds to me like you're performing for an audience or you're performing like a car engine. And neither of those has much room for pleasure. You know, I think one of the most profound things that men can do is to actually learn how to maximize our pleasure rather than focusing on how long we stay hard or how many orgasms we give a partner. Sex educator Joseph Kramer.
Is he still around? I remember him.
Yeah, he's still doing his thing. He's great.
Good.
He pointed out that most boys learn to masturbate as quickly and as quietly as possible so that they don't get caught.
That's right.
And you know, that's kind of like the sexual equivalent of, like, you know, eating food, standing over the sink really quietly so that you don't get caught eating something you're not supposed to have.
It's a good analogy.
Right. I always compare things to food.
And there are so many analogies to sex and food. It goes on and on and on.
It really does. It's true. but if you think about that, right, if that was the only kind of food that you'd ever had, you know, how are you supposed to actually savor a meal when all you know is standing over the sink and eating as quickly as possible? That just seems like we lose so many opportunities there. And so one of the things that I learned from Joe Kramer is that learning to slow down and to tune into all of the erotic potential of the entire body. You know, for men to learn how to masturbate, but do it in a way that's actually making love to yourself rather than, you know, well, let's just get this done as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it really changes everything, and it's something that I encourage a lot of my male clients to do.
A big complaint, I've heard this for years, women will say, I really want my guy to slow down, to be more sensual, and to take his time. And, you know, for guys that are experiencing premature ejaculation, sometimes called involuntary ejaculation, that can extend to slow insertion. And because I think that this is important because the most sensitive, nerve-rich part of the penis is the head. So when a man pushes into a vagina quickly, the head might become overstimulated, triggering ejaculation. So I suggest that men place the tip of his penis so that it just touches the woman's vaginal lips, get used to what it feels like, then slowly insert the head and get used to that, and to not plunge into intercourse. And besides that, many women enjoy having their vaginal lips teased this way. You know, the most erotically sensitive parts of the vagina are its lips and the area right inside the vaginal opening. Plus, a lot of men need to know about the vestibular bulbs that lie under the labia and are attached to the clitoral system. So if a man is performing cunnilingus on the woman and lightly munches her labia, then those vestibular bulbs can fill up, and it can contribute a lot to her arousal.
Exactly. And so this is, you're right. And you, what we're really talking about is slowing down and working with, you know, the physiology. We keep coming back to that word today, but that's really what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with, sex that maybe goes at a faster pace sometimes when that's what, you know, both people want to do. Sometimes you really do just want to scratch an itch in the same way that sometimes when I'm eating dinner, it's not that I want to savor my meal. I just want to not be hungry anymore so I can go do whatever else I need to go do. But when that's the only way that you can operate, that can really be a problem.
Yeah, because it means that you're kind of relying on fast food and ignoring that sometimes you want to have a gourmet feast that
exactly. Maybe
lasts an hour or longer, and maybe you bathe together and first, and you set the scene, and you allow yourselves a time to explore each other, to have fun, to laugh, to experience that sex does not have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that creates play. And, you know, I'm thinking about do you remember, I mean, this goes back 50 years, but one of the first, I think his name was Eric, I want to say Bean, but it was transactional analysis. So the ego states, the parent, the adult, and the child. And the child has two states. One is the rebellious child, which says, fuck you, with his arms crossed or her arms crossed in front of you. But the one that you want to really play with is the creative, playful child state. And where you can, and ideally, you're in that state when you're having sex, in the playful. Now, the problem is, with the parent ego state, the critical parent is usually a very strong ego state, very strong. And
such a loud voice. Critical parent has such a loud voice.
A loud voice, and usually the person with a well-developed critical parent ego state had an actual critical parent or two. But so a lot of times people will drink to excess or do other drugs to put the critical parent to sleep so that the playful child can come out to play.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting way of looking at it.
I think you're right about that. And, you know, unfortunately that ends up creating its own challenges because you end up with, you end up with situations where people, you know, can't relax into sexual pleasure without the alcohol first. And you don't get me wrong, I've got no problem with folks enjoying alcohol or whatever else that they enjoy. But when you have to have it to be able to function, that's something that's really worth looking at and seeing if maybe there are changes that you might want to make.
Yes, and the reality is that cannabis can be a much healthier. Of course, a lot of states don't have recreational cannabis available now, but
it's getting there.
It can be. But
it's
we got it here
there.
In Washington State, and it can be really a better way. I've suggested it now that it's legal, has been since 2012 in Washington State. I've suggested it to some of my couples, especially, we typically get men who who like to smoke pot, and then women who don't. So then I'll suggest an edible. Start slow. Go low. Start. You know.
Yeah.
Maybe you have half a cookie, which would be 5 milligrams. Start slow, and but it can really help. I've seen this with some of my couples where inhibitions go away. You have to feel safe with your partner. You have to trust your partner, of course. But inhibitions go away, and oftentimes their orgasms are easier to reach because you're in the moment more. So I've had some pretty good results by suggesting cannabis, and it's really healthier for you than alcohol anyway.
Yeah, I agree. Well, plus these days, in many places, and here in Washington, we have this, you can also use topical products that are actually designed for sex.
Yeah.
And one of the nice things about the topicals is that they're not psychoactive. So you don't actually alter your brain chemistry. What you're doing is either they're designed for the vagina and the vulva.
Right.
So that's an interesting possibility. So, you know, I agree with you. I think that products like this have a lot of positive potential. Cannabis and, you know, for some people, alcohol does work well. The concern that comes to my mind is if I'm this guy who's got all of this anxiety about performance and erections and all of this, if I'm using alcohol as a way of calming down the anxiety, but I'm never actually addressing the root causes of the anxiety, then that creates a dependence that I can never get rid of.
Good point.
So, what I'm really more of a fan of is, you know, let's take a look at where the anxiety is coming from and see if there is any way to approach that differently. That might be embodiment and breath work. There might be some healing work that needs to happen there. Maybe there's some education pieces. But I do a lot of work with people around, like, how do you get into your body? Because a lot of folks, and especially a lot of men, describe it as if, you know, their head is just kind of like floating around in space and the rest of their body isn't really there. So how do we reconnect to that part of ourselves?
Right.
To get into the body and to stay
mindful and present. Because a lot of people, you know, they'll try to get there and then it's just too overwhelming and they want to leave through a distraction.
Yeah. It takes practice.
And
it takes a lot of practice.
It does. It takes a lot of practice because, you know, I think we have to remember that great sex involves the whole body. And it really is based on leisurely, playful, whole body sensuality for the lovers involved. And, but that takes some practice. And you do this in your work, Dr. Charlie. I do it in my work. A very powerful thing that the therapist does, the coach does, is to give permission. You can do this. Try this. Use these words.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
use these words. Here's a tool to try, or here's a technique to explore. Yeah, it's amazing how much people can relax when somebody gives them permission to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it
permission.
Changes things.
Yeah.
Well, and that was the foundation of so here's a throwback that not a lot of people know about anymore, but the Plissett model of sex education or short-term sex
education. Oh yeah.
Counseling. Right, that the foundation is permission. That's the P. And, you know, and then limited information and specific suggestions And then at the very top was intensive therapy. But you know, in my experience as a coach and an educator, most people with sexual difficulties, they don't necessarily need a therapist, although therapy can be really incredibly valuable. But what they need is the permission. And you know, therapists are a great place to get that permission. But I think that probably 80% of what sex therapists offer doesn't require a therapist, but that 20% that does require one, you know, nobody else can do. But yeah, it's amazing how much permission makes a difference.
How much permission makes a difference. And don't you think it's also tied in with people that come out of very sort of restrictive, repressive families of origin, where there was no permission to even say what you wanted or needed. I'm not talking about sex now. We're just, you know, that it was just for some parents, it's better for the kid, for the parents, if the kid kind of stays in neutral, doesn't express either positive or negative feelings, because the parents can't handle it. So that's
And what that teaches a child is that, you know, you aren't allowed to have your own wants, needs, feelings, desires.
Exactly.
Yeah, it creates real problems.
It does. Charlie, we have to stop the program because we stop a little bit before the top of the hour. So I just wanted to tell the listeners that next week, you and I are going to talk about prostate pleasure and more. And Dr. Charlie Glickman has a wonderful book on this very topic. What is it? The Ultimate Guide to Prostate Pleasure.
That's the one.
And I noticed on your website you highlighted a Lilo sex toy that was really very well designed for prostate pleasure, and maybe that's, well, we'll talk about this next week, but maybe that's one way to begin to introduce, I don't know.
It is.
Prostate
we'll talk
pleasure.
About that next week. That's a good tease for next week.
Yeah, it is. And Dr. Charlie Glickman, you're you have so much good information, and tell people how. Because do you still give the no charge consultations for half an hour, or has that changed a little bit?
No, I still do that. So for my coaching work, you can find that at makesexeasy.com. And I do coaching here in Seattle and also over video. And because especially the video work is, either in person or video, you know, it's a very tender topic, and I know that, you know, people have a lot of hesitation around it. So I always offer a free 30-minute get acquainted call. It's a way of talking about whatever's going on for you, explore how I can help, and take it from there.
Okay, Charlie, there's our music. Talk to you next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Diana. Bye-bye.
E se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore, ma i tuoi piedi in casa.